Welcome to The Conscious Entrepreneur. I'm your host, Alex Raymond. This is the only podcast that is 100% dedicated to the well-being of entrepreneurs. Now, I know that being an entrepreneur is a long journey and it can be really tough. So on this show, we won't be sharing generic hero stories or talking about mythical unicorns. Instead, we'll get straight to the heart of what matters most, giving you tools and resources to grow, thrive, and succeed as an entrepreneur. Every week, I'll be speaking with incredible founders, CEOs, coaches, and authors to help you be more resilient and inspired as you build the business of your dreams. Growing old sucks, right? But have you ever considered that instead of being a bad thing, the challenges of midlife can actually become real catalysts for our personal and professional growth? Well, that's exactly what we are going to be discussing today with a true visionary in the fields of entrepreneurship and personal development. That's Chip Conley. As a seasoned entrepreneur, Chip has been at the forefront of the hospitality and tech industries and is currently channeling his energy and talents into a groundbreaking venture, the Modern Elder Academy. I had the privilege of meeting Chip at the Wisdom 2.0 conference in 2023, and his perspectives on aging, happiness, and the transformative midlife journey really struck a chord with me. In this episode, we'll explore Chip's career from establishing the boutique hotel chain Joie de Vivre to his pivotal role as an in-house coach and leader at Airbnb and his latest endeavor, which is MEA. We discuss the U-curve of happiness, a fascinating concept that illustrates how life satisfaction has its ups and downs, which really highlights the transformative and, dare I say, confusing nature of midlife. You'll hear from Chip about his personal trials, including his struggles during the Great Recession and a near-death experience that prompted a profound reevaluation of his life's priorities. We explore how he transformed these experiences into wisdom, ultimately leading him to found MEA. For entrepreneurs navigating the complexities of midlife, this conversation offers tremendous insight. Chip's going to share his strategies for dealing with the many changes and challenges that come as we age and how to reframe our life into a hero's journey of exploration and growth. I hope you enjoy this episode of the Conscious Entrepreneur Podcast. Chip Conley, it's a pleasure to have you on the Conscious Entrepreneur Podcast.
Thank you, Alex. Great to be here. I always wanted to be a conscious entrepreneur when I grew up.
Well, here we are. Now, you have had such an interesting career spanning hospitality, tech. Now you're working on this wonderful project, Modern Elder Academy, where you're the founder and CEO. You have so much innate wisdom. Let me put it that way. You have so much innate wisdom to share. And you may remember that you and I met in person last year in San Francisco at Wisdom 2.0, this great conference in April of last year. And I was in the audience with my wife as you were giving your talk at the event. And there was one story that you were telling and an image that you were showing that really, really struck both my wife and I. And it's the U-curve of happiness. Now, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that, because the U-curve is really this kind of view of like, what does our evolution of happiness and life satisfaction look like over time? And the way that you presented it and displayed it is you essentially said, hey, the absolute bottom is when you're 47, which is exactly the age that my wife and I were last year when we were with you in April. And so
your mileage may vary.
Indeed. Well, so we sort of looked at each other like, oh, that's why we feel like the wheels are coming off the bus all the time. Given your perspective on working with so many people who are in midlife, going through their own evolutions and changes, what does that U-curve of happiness mean to you? How should we be interpreting it?
So, thank God I didn't just come up with this myself. And my personal experience was very similar to yours. My life between 45 and 50 just sucked. And, but at that point, the U-curve of happiness was not popularized. Nobody knew it other than a few academics. So this is social science research, globally that shows that our life satisfaction starts to decline in our early to mid 20s. And it bottoms out around 45 to 50. 47.2 is on average the lowest point. And then after age 50, starting around age 50, we get happier with each decade. 50 is happier than 40s, 60s, 50s, 70s, 60s, and women in their 80s happier than 70s. So it's like this U curve, a long U curve. It sort of looks like the Amazon, the Amazon logo that they've got of like that, you know, with the little arrow on it. And I was so interested in this because the societal narrative on aging is just don't do it. And once you hit your midlife crisis around 45 or 50, it's all downhill from there. But actually that's the societal narrative. The personal narrative based upon this research shows that actually people get happier after 50. So that was in many ways for me, a door, a pathway, an opening. For me in my 50s, because I was having a beautiful 50s. I loved my 50s a lot. And I, you know, as I was imagining, you know, as an Airbnb, as the modern elder there, and helping as the in-house mentor to the founders, as I decided I wanted to create MEA, the Modern Elder Academy, I really reflected on the fact that I wonder what other kind of research is out there around aging that is like, says maybe there's a pro-aging message, not just an anti-aging message. We know the anti-aging message, which is, you know, a lot of things get worse right. With age. And I really wanted to focus on what gets better with age and why. So the why is like, okay, you know, what is it about 45 to 50 that is such a troublesome time? We can talk about that. And then also how to make it better. So that's really what my life purpose has been these days. And that's why I wrote the book, Learning to Love Midlife, 12 Reasons Why Life Gets Better with Age, as well as creating MEA 6 years ago with campuses in Baja and soon to be in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
It's such a great transition. You know, it's such a great way to think of life in stages. And what I really appreciated about the book, Learning to Love Midlife, was the way that you really paint a roadmap for people, right? And you say, you know, here's how you can think about these different stages. And we have this view, and you know, I'm a man of a certain age, and so I think, oh shit, you know, I'm getting older every year. And you're really helping me to reframe this to say, hey, there's one phase beginning, there's one phase ending. This is a natural process to how things are going. And I appreciate those reframes. What are the things that people get wrong about aging? Like what have you found to be the absolute stickiest thing, beliefs about aging?
Well, gosh, do we have 2 hours? I mean, some of the things that we get wrong is we think that our body is the only playing field of life. And so, yes, our body does get worse with age. I mean, there's all kinds of things that gets worse. Now, there's beautiful YouTube videos of people running marathons at 85 and doing yoga headstands at 75. But generally speaking, our body is like a rental vehicle we were issued at birth. And, you know, as any rental vehicle gets more mileage on it, it has more dings in it. But what's more important is not what it looks like on the outside, but what does it feel like on the inside? And so the idea that that the only playing field of life is our body is a mistake. I mean, there's the playing field of our heart and our soul, our spirituality, our brain, and we'll talk about brain in a second, or our relational playing field. There's a bunch of things we get better at. So when it comes to the brain, yes, short-term memory gets worse with age. There's no doubt about that. But actually what gets better with age is, and Arthur Brooks has written about this in his book From Strength to Strength, which profiles MEA, is we go from fluid intelligence to crystallized intelligence. When we're young, we're fast and focused in terms of our brain. When we're older, we're more holistic and systemic in our thinking, and we connect the dots. And we have more capacity to tap into intuition. So who knew that? I mean, what I knew about my brain is like, oh, as I get older, yes, I'll have short-term memory issues, and then I might have Alzheimer's or dementia. But no, actually, there's a bunch of positives here. What else gets better with age? Emotional intelligence. IQ doesn't change much with age, but EQ does. And our emotional reactivity drops with age. So our emotional intelligence grows, our emotional reactivity drops, our wisdom grows with age. Our ability to tell the narrative story of who we are, to understand who we are and get more discerning about what's important and what's not. That gets better with age. Our spiritual curiosity gets better with age. Richard Rohr, who's on our faculty at MEA and an MEA alum, and is teaching a workshop here in July at our Santa Fe Ranch campus. You know, he says the first half of our life, our operating system is our ego, and for all kinds of reasons. And then it's around midlife that there's a shift in our operating system. There's an operating system change. And yet we aren't told about it. We're not really like, oh, it goes from the ego to the soul. And but nobody gives us any roadmap or operating instructions for how to, you know, to tap into that. What we do feel is something that's stirring inside of us. So there's a lot that gets better with age. And, you know, there's in the book, I have 12 different reasons. I've just given you maybe five or six here. But what I really wanted to do is both tell my own personal story in the book, really capture the 4,300 alums who've come to Baja and their stories in the book, and then tap into social science research. Because, you know, if I'm just talking about this and it's based upon what I've observed at our Modern Elder Academy, that's not enough. It really needs to be, you know, undergirded with a foundation of, you know, an intellectual ballast of white papers and things like that. So it's an easy read, the book is, but I do really use some foundational academic research. And those folks who gave me that research are the people who've helped create our MEA curriculum in Baja and Santa Fe.
There's a tremendous amount of great material in there. And to your point, you know, you're obviously sharing your experiences and your stories and the folks that you've connected with at MEA and throughout your career. And there's a lot of academic rigor, which I think makes it an important work. And so the nice thing for me is, you know, you're really planting a flag out there, right? And you're saying, let's change how we think about this. Let's change the narrative around aging.
Yeah, it's important because actually it has health benefits. So Becca Levy at Yale, who's a big fan of MEA because we're like a living laboratory for her work, she's shown that when people shift their mindset from a negative to a positive when it comes to aging, they gain 7.5 years of additional life. There is not any physical intervention you can do. Stopping smoking at 50 gives you 4 extra years. Starting exercising at 50 gives you 2.5 extra years. Changing your diet, there's a lot of other things you could do, but none of them have as much of an effect as the sort of socio-emotional, the psychology of aging. And Bob Waldinger at Harvard's work has shown that, you know, if you want to look at the common variable for people in their 80s and 90s who are happy and healthy, look at what their social relationships were like in midlife and beyond. So the number one variable is not, you know, their wealth or their stress or how much exercise they had. The number one variable is how socially connected are they? So there's a lot of tech bros in Silicon Valley trying to help us live forever, but they tend to be extremely focused on the scientific physical side of longevity and not the socio-emotional side of longevity, which frankly at this point has a greater impact.
Well, it's a big deal because there's so much conversation these days about the negative effects of loneliness and isolation on people. For sure. And especially as a man, I will say that comes up, right? This happens. My default is to be internal or to kind of go inside, and I don't always reach out. And so I noticed that it takes extra effort to go out there and say, hey, okay, let me be social and connect and so on. And this is not just one person talking. This is happening across our entire society.
Alex, you know, I was an entrepreneur. I've been an entrepreneur my whole life, but I was an entrepreneur in my late 40s struggling, and I lost 5 friends to suicide, all of them men. Ages 42 to 52, 3 of them entrepreneurs. The commonality amongst them during the Great Recession was their sense of self-esteem was completely attached to their career, or in the entrepreneur's case is, you know, their business. And the Great Recession was quite punishing for so many businesses. And so this is really important stuff. I mean, Tony Hsieh wrote the foreword of 2 of my books and was a deeply close friend. And he's no longer living, partly because his psychology of not just aging, but being an entrepreneur really had a toxic effect on him. Blake McCoskey is a deep and close friend of mine on the MEA faculty and an MEA alum himself. He started Tom's Shoes. He was here 2 days ago spending the day with me, here in Santa Fe. And he's very public about some of what he's gone through emotionally. Since moving on from Tom's. I think men have a greater risk here men's likelihood of having what's called a successful suicide, which is a terrible, terrible language, is four times greater than with women. And so with women, you know, often they have a social infrastructure, an emotional insurance policy by being open and vulnerable with friends. And for men, we weren't necessarily bred that way. And also men are, it's not just that we have a hard time talking about the things that make us feel sad or the thing or make us feel weak. It's also that men are more likely to lose track of friendships in their 20s, 30s, and 40s than women. So it's not just an issue of capacity. It's also an issue of, I don't have any friends. And so men in their 50s, for example, are more likely to feel lonely than women, primarily because they actually let their friendship muscle atrophy. And so we've got to think of friendship as a practice. Just like anything you practice, you get better at it. You know, friendship is a practice, but it's easy in our 20s, 30s, and 40s, especially if we're an entrepreneur, to completely lose track of our friends and to not invest in friendship.
Yeah, that is hyper important and so often overlooked because we're just, you know, heads down, building the business of our dreams or whatever it is that we're doing and forgetting about how important it is to have this entire social infrastructure, as you called it, around us for our success. I know that being an entrepreneur can be a tough journey, and I want you to be able to grow your business without sacrificing yourself. That's why I want to invite you to Boulder, Colorado for the third annual Conscious Entrepreneur Summit on June 4th and 5th. This event is such a special opportunity to learn and connect with highly successful CEOs, founders, coaches, and authors. And we have two amazing keynotes this year that I want to tell you about. First, Ryan Holiday, who is a best-selling author. He's best known for his work on Stoic philosophy. He's going to be sharing about how Stoicism can transform your entrepreneurial mindset. Secondly, Sherelle Dorsey, who is an incredible entrepreneur and community builder, and she's also the host of the TED Tech podcast, will be guiding you through the evolution of technology and work and how they are intersecting. The content is amazing, but our event is about more than just learning. It's about connecting with a community of forward-thinking entrepreneurs, all dedicated to their well-being. Now, I'm obviously biased since I'm the host, but this really is a very special gathering that has the potential to completely change your business. Check out our website, consciousentrepreneur.us, for more info, and I hope to see you in June. Chip, I want to take a trip back through your career and have you connect some dots for us. Okay. Now you have a number of different really interesting roles and stories, and some of them are in this book, others are in the book Wisdom at Work, which I've also read. And help us understand the kind of the arc of the career here. You were the founder and CEO of a boutique hotel chain. Then you became a CEO coach at Airbnb, and then you founded MEA. Trace the story there and connect those dots for us.
Okay. So yeah, at 26, I went to Stanford undergrad, went to Stanford Business School, spent 2.5 years as a commercial real estate developer with a maverick real estate firm in San Francisco. Got curious about hotels. Boutique hotels were just starting to flourish in the mid-1980s. So I decided to create a company called Joie de Vivre, which means joy of life in French. Bought a motel in the Tenderloin. made it a famous rock and roll hotel called the Phoenix. And I was 26 years old at that time. Over the next 24 years, I was the founder and CEO of that company. Grew to 3,500 employees and 52 hotels. Very focused on the conscious side of business. It was really important to me. So it was not something that sort of came later. It was, you know, my book Peak, which speaks about Maslow's hierarchy of needs applied to organizations, speaks to this in a big way. How can we be social impactful, not just externally, but internally? You know, the culture was really, really important to me. And Hospitality companies are generally, you know, companies full of line level workers making an hourly wage. And so I really wanted to be different than most of those factories, most of those hospitality factories where employees felt really victimized by the experience. So long story short is we won a lot of awards for best place to work, things like that. But in my late 40s, I struggled and everything that could go wrong was going wrong in my life. And I didn't want to do it anymore. Had this NDE where I died, you know, 9 times in 90 minutes from a allergic reaction to an antibiotic. And that was my wake up call as a hotelier to say, I don't want to do this anymore. And over the next couple of years, I figured out how to sell the company at the bottom of the Great Recession. I had had some suicide ideation myself and I knew like this was not healthy for me. I don't want to do this anymore. And so I was able to sell it, you know, but I took a huge bath relative to what I could have sold at 4 years later, but I knew my life was that important. And so I created space. And in my early 50s, I had what we call a midlife atrium, space to reflect upon how do I want to consciously curate the rest of my life. And I knew there's a great movie, The Intern, where Robert De Niro at some point in the movie says, musicians don't retire. They quit when there's no more music left inside of them. So I knew I had music inside of me and I don't know what I would have called it. I now would call it wisdom. And I wanted to share it. But I didn't know, like, how do you at 50 or 52 years old share that wisdom with someone else? And I was just lucky. I was lucky that Brian Chesky, the co-founder and CEO of Airbnb, reached out to me 11, 12 years ago when almost nobody had heard of Airbnb and said, listen, we're a small tech startup and we're growing internationally pretty quickly. But none of us know anything about hospitality or travel or entrepreneurship or leadership or you name it. And we'd like to have you come in-house and be our in-house coach, our modern elder, but also be the head of global hospitality and strategy. So I spent 4 years full-time and traveling the world, sort of helping to be the secretary of state of that company. And then 3.5 years after that, part-time as a strategic advisor, leading us up to the IPO that led to Airbnb being the most valuable hospitality company in the world. That was fascinating. But that experience, so I was able to take what I call same seed, different soil. I was able to take my seed of what I learned about hospitality and travel and leadership and entrepreneurship and creating a culture, creating strategy, and then apply it in a whole new set of soil, a new, you know, a place where like a tech company. And I had to be the mentor in there, a mentor and an intern, because I'd never worked in a tech company. So I didn't know what I was doing at times. But that experience in my 50s, where I really loved that after having the rough late 40s, woke me up to the fact like there's a lot of people out there in midlife who could use some help to understand how to become a modern elder or how to, you know, reimagine and repurpose themselves, not just professionally, but even personally. And so that's how MEA came about. So, you know, hospitality has been true for all three of these, but I went from bricks and mortar to tech to now a combination of tech because we have two campuses, but we also have a very robust online set of programs for MEA. And we also have regenerative communities. We have residential communities.
So cool. I mean, and so I see how the coaching and the wisdom is a through line. I see how hospitality is a through line. You're obviously someone who wants to create and curate experiences for people. That's coming through loud and clear.
I learned I'm a social alchemist. If we're lucky enough in life, we can distill down our gift. I love this quote from David Viscott, who says, "The purpose of life is to find your gift or discover your gift. Purpose of life is to discover your gift. The work of life is to develop it. And the meaning of life is to give it away." And so, yeah, I've realized I'm a social alchemist. I've realized I'm a CEO whisperer. And, you know, these are the kinds of things we help people with at MEA because, we don't necessarily have a lot of time in our lives to figure out, like, what is my mastery? What's my gift? What's my wisdom? Because once you actually unlock that and do the archaeological dig to figure that out, man, are you ready to go out and share that in the world?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, like Gay Hendricks says, it's your zone of genius. It's what are you exclusively, uniquely good at doing and what are you bringing to the world? And I love that. I love that gift idea. Tell me what's it been like to do two campuses? One campus is probably hard enough in Baja. And then you decided, hey, I want to do something even bigger in Santa Fe, New Mexico. How's that been?
It's scary a little bit. I'll be honest. We have a lot of demand. And so coming up with a second campus, this time in the US, the first one being in Mexico. Most of the majority of our people who code at our campus in Mexico are from the US, although we've had people from 47 countries come there. So it's wild how many people from around the world have come. But we really needed a US campus, and Santa Fe felt right. And we found this, you know, this beautiful 2,600 acre regenerative horse ranch. And we decided, okay, we're going to put two retreat centers on this 2,600 acres. So our fastest growing part of our business is private groups. So sometimes it's like peer to peer networks like YPO or Vistage or EO or Extraordinary Women on Boards. And then a lot of it's public workshops. And in the pub, and sometimes it's companies too. Sometimes companies will say, like, hey, if you look at the MEA website, which is meawisdom.com, at the bottom of the website, you know, the bottom footer, there's a bunch of free resources. And one of the papers is called Why Successful Leaders Value Wisdom. And there are a lot of companies that have read that paper and said, like, we want to be a wiser company. And if MEA is a midlife wisdom school, how do you help a leadership team become wise? And so that's, so we've done a lot of, you know, B2B kind of business stuff too, but we're really first and foremost a public workshop place, a place where people come. And whether it's to go to a Michael Franti workshop about finding your rhythm in midlife, or Richard Rohr or Liz Gilbert or Dan Buettner, we have a partnership with Blue Zones and do four Blue Zones workshops a year. It's really, you know, it's fascinating to see that there's enough demand for this. But I'm also still sort of scared, because to go from one retreat center to really three, because we have two on this ranch campus, is a lot to digest.
Awesome. Thank you. One of the things I want to do is I want to dig into some of the stuff that's in your book about your personal journey. And you mentioned that, you know, you started Joie de Vivre when you were young. You were 26, you're one of the, you know, and there's several times in your books where you talk about, you know, what am I doing here? Imposter syndrome, you know, this kind of feeling of like, do I actually belong? And, you know, imposter syndrome is a big deal for a lot of entrepreneurs, because an entrepreneur will go out there and say, hey, I'm going to go do this. And then very quickly they start to feel, wow, everybody else is so much farther ahead than I am. And they're more experienced and they've raised more money and they have bigger companies and whatever. The brain, you know, creates all sorts of stories around that. How has your experience of dealing with that changed as you have evolved yourself? Like, what would you tell a younger entrepreneur or the younger Chip Connelly who is facing imposter syndrome or similar thoughts?
Well, I've moved from imposter syndrome to explorer syndrome. And that means sometimes I don't know what I'm going to be doing. I mean, I don't really understand it. And so I have to be an explorer. I have to be willing to learn. And that's not a bad thing. But it also means sometimes I have to surround myself with people who know more than I do. And for some entrepreneurs, that's really hard. Because from an ego perspective, you want to be the hero. You want to be the smartest person in the room. And, you know, sometimes you have to other people there who are going to be calling you on your BS and helping you to see things that you just aren't seeing. And that's whether that's on a personal level or it's actually on a sort of knowledge level of something you just don't understand, it's really valuable. It's really also valuable to explain what you don't understand. I think people loved me at Airbnb because they thought I came in as the old, you know, modern elder. And they said, like, oh, but he's curious. He's not just wise. He's curious. And he's a mentor. He's both a mentor and an intern. And that helped because it really, you know, made me more humble and more accessible. Over the course of my time at Airbnb, I had over 100 mentees in 7.5 years. It's a lot. And it's partly because people like really wanted to sort of lean in and learn more. But I think for me personally, the most important practice I've ever had in my life around wisdom is something I started doing at age 28. So this is 2 years after I started Joie de Vivre. And I was like such an idiot. I didn't know what I didn't know. And then I realized, oh, I don't know a lot of stuff. And I have this company that I'm running, like, oh my God. And then we had an earthquake in San Francisco and, oh, nobody's coming to San Francisco because there's aftershocks and there's the Bay Bridge part of it collapsed and the marina's on fire. Like, oh my God. So one day I went home and I just said, like, I'm lost. I took a personal journal off the bookshelf that I'd never written in, and I wrote on the cover of it my wisdom book. And I started a practice I've been doing for 35 years. Every weekend, I sit down with my wisdom book and I write down, what did I learn this week? Like little bullet points. So it's not a journal, like an emotional journal. It's more practical in the sense of it's like, here's what I learned this week. And usually the lessons I learned were painful because our painful life lessons are the raw material for our future wisdom. And so I learned these lessons. I made note of what they were. And then I would write in my journal, and here's how it's going to serve me in the future, which is really an interesting bridge. Because if you just have a painful life lesson, but it's not going to be helpful to you in the future, then it just feels painful. You know, and what I really needed to do is help myself see I'm learning something along the way. And that's what helped me to not feel like an imposter. Because actually I felt like, okay, I am documenting. And I've been doing this for so long. Now, I do it in Google Docs now, but for the longest time, I have nine different wisdom journals. And when I was going through the Great Recession, I could go back to the .com bust 9/11 journals and say like, okay, what did I learn back then? Because right now I need some serious wisdom. So I think, you know, believing that you can learn. So this is a growth mindset versus a fixed mindset. A fixed mindset has this belief that you have a fixed amount of knowledge. Your job is to optimize it or a fixed amount of capacity or skill. And you're supposed to optimize it. And you want to prove yourself and you want to win. A growth mindset is less focused on proving yourself and more focused on improving yourself. And it's not about winning, it's about learning. And so shifting your mindset from fixed to growth and being willing to actually be the idiot who is learning something and you something that everybody thinks that you know, but you don't know yet, is part of what makes an entrepreneur effective in becoming a better entrepreneur. And Brian Chesky, I'll say, at 21 years, my junior CEO of Airbnb, a guy I reported to because I was head of global hospitality and strategy, but a guy I mentored, I learned from him. He was such a voracious learner and was really open to admitting what he didn't know. So I love that I learned that from you know, someone 21 years, my junior.
Yeah. Very cool. One of the tools that you mention in Learning to Love Midlife is based on Joseph Campbell's work of The Hero's Journey. And to me, this is a really powerful way to reframe what am I going through? Because as an entrepreneur, it's really easy to get stuck in the day in, day out of just like, oh, you know, the sky is falling in on me. Everything that's going wrong that could go wrong is going wrong at the same time. And it's really helpful to reframe through this lens of the hero's journey. And part of that is the growth mindset versus fixed mindset that you were just talking about. Part of it is being able to see the arc of your career, the arc of your existence, and craft a narrative around that. What are the things that you've learned from the hero's journey, and how do you recommend people like practically apply that?
So for those who don't know the hero's journey, it's really just it's a three-stage frame that Joseph Campbell put out in the world, and George Lucas liked it enough to make his Star Wars movies based upon it. So there's really three stages. There's you're in the default world, starting with life is relatively normal, but something's not quite right, or something's like eating at you, or there's something coming through you that you're channeling. And that takes you from this sort of default normal world to the call to adventure. And the call to adventure is the second stage where you're willing to go out and sort of do the thing that is not like normal for you and maybe not easy and maybe a little awkward and liminal. And then during that time, you actually come face to face with all kinds of demons, both internal and external, and challenges. And then you get to the third stage of the hero's journey where you're coming back into the normal world, but a new person. You've learned something along the way. You're evolved in some way. So to be able to look at your own life and to see when in your life have you had a hero's journey, and quite specific situations, or maybe even the global perspective on my life is just one big hero's journey. What I tried to do in the chapter, in one of the chapters in the book, I think it's chapter 8, was to really help show how I designed and could articulate my own hero's journey. And what are the common patterns I fall into? Because it's in that second phase where you come face to face with your shadow side. And the shadow side it's almost unconscious. It's also like sort of qualities about yourself that you're not very proud of, but actually get you in trouble over and over again. And so for me, I know that like one of my shadow sides is I have a tendency to live by the African proverb, the first part of the proverb, which is, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And I'm pretty much, I can be a loner and a lone wolf, and I get a lot done quickly, but I end up being resentful. Like, my team is way back there. Like, where the hell are you guys? And so I see myself not really collaborating with them well enough. And so, you know, I've tried to get better at that. Because I see what the effect of that is, you know, if I don't get better at that. And so this, so I think this is not something you can do at 25. It's something you can do at 45 and 50 and 75 for sure. And, but it also takes a certain amount of willingness to be conscious about how you show up in the world and, you know, open to the shadow side of your personality.
Yeah. Wow. It's one of these things that it sounds like a fun exercise. Like, oh yeah, I'll just paint the narrative here for myself. And then like you're saying, shadow comes up. And even, you know, I mean, entrepreneurs face this all the time. It's like, hey, I thought this was a good idea. I you know, it's one of those things that people say, I did this because I thought it was going to be easy. And lo and behold, it isn't. So a lot of stuff comes up for people and turns out to be a challenge. And that's where the work happens. And that's also where the magic happens.
Yes, exactly.
Now, as you think of the what you've called the midlife chrysalis, or the changes that people go through, how does that impact your views, and how does it change your views on things like being of service, giving back, building community? How does all that come together as we're going through an evolution and getting hopefully wiser as we age?
Well, it's the idea of the midlife chrysalis is, you know, it is what the butterfly is. The midlife for the butterfly is the chrysalis. And yeah, it's dark and gooey and solitary, but it's also where the transformation happens. And again, Richard Rohr has been a big influence on me, and his work is saying that we shift from the primary operating system being our ego to our soul around midlife is when I think Eric Erickson, the developmental psychologist, says we start to think of our life as, you know, it's not I am my business card, or I am, you know, how much I own, or I am what people say about me. It's more like I am what survives me. And it is that shift to I am what survives me, and the shift to being beyond your own personal selfish needs and looking at what impact you're having. I mean, I think people do it at all ages, but it really, for many people, you come face to face with it in midlife, maybe the core of midlife, between maybe 45 and 60. And what it leads to is, you know, going from the return on investment mentality to the ripples of impact mentality, where your life is defined not by, you know, the internal rate of return, but based upon the impact, the ripples of impact you're helping to create out there in the world. And for me, that's exactly where I am. I've not made a salary in 6 years. I don't intend to pay myself from MEA. I am investing a huge amount of money in the growth of this community. And I get my sense of satisfaction and success from connecting with our alums and seeing how their lives have been changed. And I mean, it sounds awfully cliche, but I'm a big fan of It's a Wonderful Life and Clarence, the angel coming down to find Jimmy Stewart, George Bailey on the bridge about to jump off, and like showing him what his little town would have been like if George Bailey or Jimmy Stewart had never existed. And that's how I think all of us should feel, is, you know, our role is in the second half of our adult life is to prepare for our eulogy, not our resume.
Wow. Thank you. Chip, one last question, has to do with the amount of your output in the work. You've written a lot of books. You wrote, obviously, Learn to Love Midlife. You wrote Peak, Rebel Rules, Wisdom at Work. I know a lot of entrepreneurs.
Seven books.
Okay, seven books. You've written seven books. I know a lot of entrepreneurs. I know a lot of people who want to write books. What is it that motivates you to get the word out like that? How do you go about it? What's it like to actually do this work and write a book?
and a daily blog too. So I mean, it's like, thank God I like to write. I mean, when I was a teenager, I wanted to be a writer when I grew up, and my dad said, that's not a practical thing. And so I really put it to bed. And then it was in my late 30s when I'd been running Joie de Vivre for over 10 years. It had become big and people were asking me to give speeches. And one day I gave a speech and a literary agent came up after the speech and said, have you ever thought about writing a book? And I laughed. I said, I thought about writing books all the time, but I'm just running a company now. I don't have time to do it. And she says, make the time. You have a great story. I don't know if you're a good writer. And I told her, I think I'm a pretty good writer. And so that's how it all started with the book, The Rebel Rules, Daring to Be Yourself in Business. Richard Branson wrote the foreword. And since then, it's just been, I've seen writing as a way of documenting what I'm learning and to sharing it with others. So, I thank God I love it. Thank God I like to wake up early in the morning, because from 4:30 to 7:30, that's my best writing time. And that's really before I'm doing any work. And so when I'm writing a book, that's what I'm typically writing.
Wow, fantastic. There's a lot of wisdom. There's a lot of inspiration in what you do. Thanks so much for sharing your journey. MEA is such a gift and such a fantastic organization. Thank you for doing that. Really appreciate you for coming on this podcast with us, Chip Connelly. Thanks for being here. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Conscious Entrepreneur. If you're ready to go deeper into working on yourself, check out the upcoming events, articles, and resources on our website, which is consciousentrepreneur.us. I'd also really like to thank the team at Hivecast for producing this episode. If you run a podcast and are looking for an awesome full-service production company, make sure to check out Hivecast.